Good morning and welcome to Turning Pages. I'm Lyons Filmer, and with me this morning is Catherine Cook, who's going to be presenting a conversation about Festival of First Fruits. Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Lyons. Thank you for having me.
And on the telephone is farmer Peter Martinelli. Good morning, Peter. You're on the air.
Good morning, Lyons, and good morning, Catherine.
Dear listeners, I would like to invite you to join with me and Peter Martinelli to do an inquiry and actually find out what it's all about or find something out about what it's all about. The Festival of First Fruits, or Lammas Day, is celebrated in the Celtic universe as the halfway mark between summer solstice and fall equinox. What's going on in the heavens is, I understand it, is the northern hemisphere begins to tilt away from the sun, beginning longer nights. And in Celtic lands, this festival is celebrated with harvest, singing, dancing, wooing, and the gathering of wildflowers. I also think of it, of all the cross-quarter days, as being stable points in the yearly calendar, as at the time of the solstice and equinox, the rising and setting points of the sun are moving quickly from one direction to another along the horizon. Lammas Day is noted in the Tibetan calendar as Ratna, and it is thought of as a time of richness. The metaphor often used is the richness of a rotting oak log. And the stone amber is also associated with it. Peter, do you want to tell us about how this is affecting your farming where you are?
Sure, Catherine. Can you hear me well enough?
I can hear you now. Thank you.
Great. Well, what I noticed here on the ground is that this period of time, what I think of as sort of the middle of the summer, for growing crops here on the coast is an amazing time because soil temperatures are at their peak and the soil itself is very well balanced because of the high temperature. The nutrients are pretty much are well broken down and therefore available as quality plant food. So the plant health is at its peak. The growth of crops is very it's very even and it's very strong, and it's a wonderful time to plant for either the late fall or right now we even start to think about planting for winter time. And it's better to go a little early because of this phenomenon right now where the soil is at a really optimal state in which to start plants, start seeds, and have exceptional growth. And when you go into winter, you want your plants to be well grown and quite healthy to handle the extremes of winter, and you get a much better winter crop. So it's a wonderful time. It's the best time of year to plant and, frankly, to garden.
So that sort of corroborates this sense of this time of year as being balanced and stable and rich and harmonious. So that is actually a reflection in the soils and in the plants' response to the soils of what's going on in the planets. Would you agree with that? Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Things are balanced and stable, and by contrast, trying to start things in the spring when we're in an ascendant phase, climate is unstable, temperatures in the soil are unstable, and all kinds of cycles, heavy wind, heavy rain, extremes. And it's the stability is a big part of why things are so good right now.
Yes, and I think part of why it's inspiration to celebrate the season.
Absolutely.
So let's see, I'm going to move on now a little bit, still in the context of what's going on in the air and what's going on in the heavens. I'm going to read two short poems. What air conveys? Air, this fragile ocean of air, brings with her all she's touched, conveys to me right now the power and strength of our towering redwoods, which within her bend to me inform my very standing here, my also upright nature, where pressed against the face and breast of nature, I drink to breathe in the fragrance of the ocean of air, especially woodsy scented now. This next poem is called Approaching Vernal Equinox, and although that's not the one we're celebrating right now, it does talk about the relationship of the world of plants to the air, which is part of what we're examining in this inquiry. Approaching Vernal Equinox. Before the thrift store, Rosa chinensis, rosy pink, first blooms, edge winged, fragile into the air. Turning the walkway, ceanothus, densely sweet perfume, drenches me, it clouding up from within its infinity of so tight, tiny buds. Next, I bend to delicate handfuls, small pink bouquets of manzanita blossom opening, it all budded out among the natives lining the walkway to the library. Time slows down or disappears as we approach cross-quarter day, halfway between the solstice and the equinox, called Imbolc or sheep's milk by the Celts, the beginning of lambing season. Before them, Hippocrates said, for good health, walk among aromatic plants daily and bathe in their essential oils. Is there any kind of comment you would like to make about the function of air, the atmosphere, or how that's affecting what's going on with you?
Sure, absolutely. I'd love to.
Okay.
The your first poem resonated pretty deeply with me because you touched upon the sort of the aroma of the coastal air, which of course, living here in Bolinas, I'm very familiar with it. And taking it down to the ground and being here in the gardens, it actually very much affects the way I operate on a day-to-day. In this location, when we have, and I'll be a little more technical in talking about the atmosphere, because that's sort of how I relate to it, but when there's a south-flowing wind, which in our case, we are in a valley that's sort of northwest, north-south facing, there's always a wonderful aroma of the ocean in the air. The humidity is quite high. And typically, the strength of the south wind will tell me whether or not, generally it's associated with the fog. So if we have a south breeze blowing here, I can generally count upon a foggy evening. And if there's a more intense south wind, I can count upon foggy day all day long. And it really influences, it's very good for the kind of plants that I grow, especially the greens and the kales and the beets and those sort of water-loving plants that not only love irrigation, but they love to have their foliage get wet. And there's just something wonderful about these greens. And this morning's a great example of these greens being sort of, drenched in dew with this rich coastal air in this south flow that we get this time of year in the fog that makes the greens just really, they're very crispy. They're at their peak, their optimum of quality when they've spent the night in a condition like this. And if you went inland just over Mount Tam, you probably wouldn't have a night like this and you would have very different plants. They wouldn't be as succulent and tender as what we're growing here. They would be probably more leathery because they're dealing with low humidity, high temperatures during the day. So that air is a very major influence for the quality. And the opposite pattern, and typically when there's a south pattern, there's fog in Bolinas, there will probably be clearer weather in Point Reyes. The opposite pattern is what I call a northwest flow, which will often make fog to the north-facing shorelines, such as Point Reyes, Tomales, Marshall, and we'll be in the clear down here, and I'll need to think more about harvesting earlier in the day because I know the temperatures are going to come up and the sun's going to be out. And I need to think more about irrigation because there's not going to be as much moisture. So it's the air that you referenced in that poem is a huge influence on what we do.
Thank you. That's very beautifully put. You're reminding me of Green Gulch, where, you know, I spent 20 years actually growing things in the fog. And one of my favorite memories is of an early morning standing in what was then called the horse pasture, looking down a long line of Bloomsdale spinach. Bloomsdale spinach on the ground with drops of dew on all the leaves, and then rising up on this white fence above it was sweet pea trellis going up about 8 feet tall.
Wow.
Down the whole length of this little valley, you know, maybe it was a couple hundred feet. And it was unforgettable. I will just never forget that sight of the spinach and the white fence and the sweet peas.
But it's something about the way the water will stand on something like it, almost like a you know, it stands apart, and you really get a sense of the coating of water.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I think there's something about dew and collecting dew, and it was originally used as a holy water in some, you know, some, I don't know, was it Catholic maybe? I'm not sure which religion, but yeah, it has a very special quality.
It is, and some plants, a lot of plants, in fact, particularly a good example would be the squash family, which are native, I believe, native to the Americas and to places where rain is not a constant thing. And those plants are actually, they've evolved to capture whatever atmospheric moisture is available, such as dew. And if you look at them, you look at the leaves on a squash plant, it's this wonderful little basin that of a leaf that captures the moisture, and it's like a beautiful watershed that goes right down to the bottom of that leaf and then down the stem and right to the root. And on a wet morning, you can actually observe these plants basically watering themselves with their own structure.
What a wonderful image. Catherine, may I just take this moment to remind listeners that are listening to KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin. I'm Lyons Filmer, running the board for Catherine Cook, who's presenting this program on the Festival of First Fruits. And with us on the telephone is farmer Peter Martinelli, who runs Fresh Run Farms in Bolinas.
So, Peter, just to give listeners a sense of your farm there, how many acres are you cultivating? And I've seen one picture of it on the web, and it looked like a lot of it was in kind of a shallow bowl. Is that correct? Or
yeah, that's fairly correct. We're located in Paradise Valley, which is approximately 2 miles north of the town of Bolinas. We're right in the center of the Bolinas Peninsula, pretty much where the peninsula separates from the rest of the land. And Paradise Valley is a series of basically bowl-shaped fields starting all the way down at Bolinas Lagoon, and it's incredible bottom soil. It's probably I would bet it to be one of the best soils in definitely Marin County, possibly up there with some of the better soils in California. Although it's such a small area that it's not, you know, it's not on the radar as something like, say, the Sacramento Valley. But yeah, these bowls, so to speak, these little, you know, one of them's 4 acres, one of them's 7 acres. And there are a few other miscellaneous patches, but those are the primary two that comprise about 15 acres of constant production. There's about 20-odd acres available at any given time, but I use about three-quarters of it. And wonderful microclimates. One of the bowls, the first one, the 4-acre one, is oriented more to the sort of more to the south, has a little more wind exposure, and it's a cooler field. And the 7-acre one tilts more southeast, northwest, which to me is probably the most optimal direction for constant sunlight. It heats up a lot more. I have better results with warm crops in there. And these bowls are surrounded by high ridge to the west, which is sort of the end point of the Inverness Ridge. And it rises to about 500 or 600 feet, which provides a tremendous backstop to the Pacific Ocean, and it allows the temperatures to rise and allows us to grow things like tomatoes and squash and warmer weather crops. And to the east, we have a lower, about a 200-300 foot ridge. So all this protection and heat building, mm-hmm. combined with the coastal influence and the soil I mentioned, makes for just a fantastic, very unique place to grow food.
Yeah, you're reminding me again of Green Gulch, and one other aspect of the fog is that, especially what my job was growing flowers, and the way colors look in the fog is pretty amazing. There's a kind of beauty that happens when the fog is covering the whole planting area. So, let's see, how many people are there with you cultivating this farm?
Currently, we have five people working here, and I have a primary manager, Will Scott, who's been here. I believe this is his fifth year on the farm, and we try to keep Will employed year round, which is sort of difficult with the coastal California winters, but we're getting better at that. And the other four are seasonal people who work here, and I try to find people, workers who are really interested, genuinely interested in organic food production, and at least, you know, if not wanting to become farmers, at least have a very keen interest in the organic method and in quality food. And I have a wonderful crew this year. It's the largest crew I've ever had, and which is a little bit scary in terms of the cash flow situation, but they're doing an outstanding job. I think the farm has never looked better or never been poised to be more productive. So it's a very exciting year, and I'm grateful to have such a great group of people working here with me.
You know, I can sort of sense that at the Saturday morning market, just the energy of the crew that's there selling your produce.
Yes.
They are dedicated.
They are.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to change the subject here a little bit. And I'd like to spend some time talking about grassland. Mm-hmm. What's really stands out when we look around the environment right now is that the hills have turned to a kind of crispy brown. And I was really enchanted and pleased to discover that at one time the whole east shore of Tomales Bay was clothed in perennial grasses. And that, for me, to just imagine what the east shore of Tomales Bay would look like if it was all green all summer long is a really big deal. And there's a whole history involved, I'm not going to get into it now, but of how annual grasses came to supplant the perennial grasses. But I think it's important to just keep in mind that is the history, that is the origin of the vegetation that we have now on the east shore of Tomales Bay. And let's see, I'm going to read a few poems on grass, and then hopefully we can have some discussion with you.
Great.
This one is called Three Riffs on Grass. One, lawn reduction, easy. That's lawn, L-A-W-N. Lawn reduction, easy. Once into it, among the weeds, I note that all, this is the backyard where I live, by the way. Once into it, among the weeds, I note that all I need to do is simply cut the seed stalks off the taller imported annual exotic grasses and let them fall to the ground. No regeneration possible if done before the seed is ripe. With that single effort, the lawn can then revert to native ground covers already in place. Wild strawberry, coastal poppy, clovers, yarrow, and other nutrient lovelies that bloom and leaf out close to the ground don't mind being walked on. Plenty of room appears to tend the borders of our beautiful climbing roses in two shades of pink and wisteria lavender. Beautiful to boot, effortless to manage, nothing here that has to be mowed. More beauty, food, and life, no petrochemicals, no money needed to pay a man to push a lawnmower. 2. How is it that I find myself cutting down for weeds, seed-bearing grasses, like those my native California land ancestors gathered for food? I'm doing this to simply have a place to walk, where they would have swished through in chest-high grass with seed beaters, knocking the grains off grass to fall in their baskets. 3. When I read about those native California sisters of so long ago, wading on hill trails through breast-high grasses, harvesting seed together, I long to walk back through time, into and through the pages of Malcolm Margolin's Ohlone Way, to arrive in the native California past, go there, be with them, walk the hills where they walked with them, and gather seed for food for my people. More than anything else, that is what I want to do. When I first read Kat Anderson's Tending the Wild, one of the things that really stood out for me was the way that people managed, how can I say this? The trees in the forest were spaced far enough apart so that the air and light could reach the ground, and there would be a whole layer of grass, edible seeds under the forest floor. So the production of the acorns was integrated with this whole layer of grassland that fed small animals, invited rabbits and deer to come in to the area under cultivation, and then, you know, they were easy prey in that sense. So there's one story worldwide where people, especially Europeans, I think, went into an area and cut all the trees down in order to farm. So when I read about this integration of tree life and tree crops and grassland, it just rang a very deep kind of bell for me. So this is a section of a poem. Co-evolving with the tall trees, high branches, densely loaded with edible seeds and nuts, our female forebears calculated the geometry of the culture of layered living foods to space these coast live oak at optimum distances to favor health, circulation of the air, of light, of rain to reach the forest floor, which then received the seed, the thriving forest understory, meadows, and grassland, which fed the birds and animals hunted and the tribe. The staple food was grass seed harvested by women with seed beaters who could harvest and carry up to 40 pounds a day. It was very interesting to me that acorns were thought to be a less reliable food source than the grass seed. And so that was what they really depended on. So let's just stop there for a minute, and I'd be interested in hearing your reflections on that aspect of our native landscape.
Sure. I think in a broader sense, a thought that resonated as you were talking is the idea that we are especially in West Marin, but all over, basically everywhere, we're living in a very much changed environment from what was here before the European and Americans settled the land. And, you know, many very vibrant parts of that original ecosystem have thrived and have rallied back. But when you're talking about plant species and integrated systems of grasslands and forests, some areas are very severely altered. And in West Marin, I did a bit of work on this when I actually was in school in over in Berkeley years ago, and fascinating topic. We had a great deal of the area around here, particularly down where I am in Bolinas and on the slopes of Mount Tam in every direction, were very heavily forested areas. And the way in which this area was settled was very rapid because of the gold rush and the instant evolution of San Francisco, because people just showed up in an overnight, in effect, and had all of the needs of a city. Where, you know, they needed to build it, they needed to fuel it, feed it. And so the transformation of land out in this area was very rapid and very intensive, and most of the hills in Marin were stripped of their standing timber, and Douglas fir and redwood being chief among them. And then what followed was perhaps even more intensive, was the harvesting of firewood to fuel the city. There weren't any coal mines, there weren't any oil fields. It was pretty much all about wood in those days. So we have a very changed landscape by development at that time, and also a very changed landscape by the sudden need to produce food. And there are all kinds of interesting stories of terrible things that happened, such as when all the logging was done, there was, you know, plowing up of the newly opened ground. That once the stumps were burned up and removed or chained out with mules, they planted potatoes on slopes. And many of our bays and watersheds were heavily silted and impacted by slope agriculture, whether it was growing potatoes or wheat, or they had to grow everything. They couldn't import it from anywhere. So imagine the intensity of agriculture in the last half of the 19th century was amazing, and impacts that we don't understand or we can't even see. You know, how deep was Bolinas Lagoon is a huge argument that goes back and forth. And it's important to mention these things because a lot of the attitudes and a lot of the decisions that are made today about environmental things are often based on perhaps a misguided view of what the land should be or what it was, because it's been so altered. And a lot of these debates are, a number of them, I think, are sort of imbalanced in their approach, because we really don't know how these things function. And a lot of our watersheds are still choked up with material from activities that happened ages ago. And one hydrologist explained to me that it might take couple of hundred years for a watershed to completely digest a logging event or something like that. But taking it down to the plants and the seeds, I think it's very, you know, you're spot on. And a lot of these plants that we have take to be natural or normal native plants, or not necessarily native, but just sort of part of the landscape, aren't from here. And on the farm, we're constantly battling, you know, old friends that are weeds and new friends, and they've come from all different places and sources over time. And I think it's just important to understand that, you know, when we try to get back or try to restore places or view the natural environment, that there's a good deal of compromise, I think, that we need to make. You know, we're never going to get it back to what it was, but I think we have to learn, or the environment figures it out. It sorts itself out, and, you know, non-native learns to function with native. And there are things that you know, we do need to control that are going to wipe out a species, or, you know, can fundamentally change an ecosystem. But there are the things we just have to learn to tolerate, and it happens on the farm, too. There are just certain weeds, such as amaranthus, that has been very, very closely associated with human activities and cultivation for centuries and has learned to adapt itself to us. And it's therefore one of the most difficult weeds to control by virtue of its adaptation to our activity on the soil. So there are all kinds of things in play, and you're, you know, like, you have to look at what's going on with a very broad eye.
Peter, I love that image that you've just offered us from the hydrologist, of that it could take up to 200 years for a watershed to digest that tree cutting or whatever change that was. That's amazing. It's KWMR. I'm Lyons Filmer, doing the controls here with Peter Martinelli on the telephone. Peter has Fresh Run Farm in Bolinas, and our host is Catherine Cook, who's bringing to us poetry and land and soil and flower and plant understandings here on the cross quarter day of Lammas, the festival of the first fruits. I'm going to take a tiny break so that I can make a thank you to two more of our underwriters who support Community Radio, KWMR. Axel Nelson for Home Base, a West Marin nonprofit organization that supports Love Field and hosts progressive youth baseball programs and community interaction at games, gatherings, and events. For more information, please email safeathomebase@gmail.com. And Point Reyes Farmstead Cheese Company, offering handcrafted artisan cheese, including Toma and Point Reyes Original Blue. The farm's culinary and educational center, The Fork, offers farm-to-table culinary experiences and is available for events. More information at 1-800-591-6878 or online, pointreyescheese.com or The Fork at Point Reyes. Stay with us here on KWMR, Point Reyes Station, and Bolinas. We'll be back in just a moment with more about the Festival of First Fruits. Catherine Cook and Peter Martinelli. Festival of the First Fruits.
Peter, thank you for that description of the complexity of historical events that we are faced with, dealing with when we try to think about how to care for our land. I think often about how do we get ourselves into this dichotomy between wilderness and cultivated land, which is all part of what you're referring to there. It, you know, many different kinds of mix-ups and confusion and history, layers of history.
Yes.
But, you know, for me, sorting it out, I sort of finally came to this position that ideally, I mean, when we talk about where we're trying to go with this at this time in history, ideally, cultivated land would be a kind of intensification of what's going on in wild land.
Uh-huh.
So that a good example of that for me is the elderberry bush. And one of the things I read about in Tending the Wild was how the women pruned the elderberry to encourage it to produce more fruit. So it seemed to me that that was an intensification of the elderberry if it were just left alone in the wilderness. But it seemed to me an appropriate human activity in terms of honoring the wild roots of things and still cultivating food. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So, and that principle of intensification, I know when I studied French intensive biodynamic gardening, there was a lot that was like that. When we planted out the lettuce bed, the seedlings were planted so that we could harvest the young lettuce at one time and leave room on the same bed for the rest of the lettuce to grow to fill in the bed to be harvested at a larger size.
Yeah.
And that's an example of intensification.
Mm-hmm.
So that's to think about that. That seems to be the way, at least theoretically, to get out of the dichotomy between uh-huh. wild and cultivated. Do you have any comments on that? Or?
Sure. I think of it very similarly to what you're talking about, and I like to put a term around it because of managing for abundance. And what I mean by that is you start by looking at nature, looking at what nature's already doing, say in a given location. And I'll give you an example where I live here in the valley and on the shores of Pine Gulch Creek. There's a tremendous abundance of wild nettle, and I've been harvesting them for years and years, but I figured out a way. You know, I started doing it the way everybody did, which is to go in there with a knife and cut down the plant and take the leaves. And over time, I've sort of evolved. And mind you, these are stinging nettles, so they're not, you know, it's not a simple proposition as far as comfort goes. But over the years, I've worked up a way of harvesting the leaves off of the plants and leaving the plant intact. And what nettles do is that, you know, like all of these things, humans are not the only critter out there harvesting them. And most of these, just about anything in nature, has, you know, its enemies, or I should say its consumers, you know, those in the food chains that it feeds. And the abundance, they tend to grow, you know, with that going on, things tend to grow in abundance so that they have enough to sustain the species, yet actually feed part of the ecosystem. So in the case of the nettles, what I discovered was as all these little bugs eat the leaves the same way, particularly whitefly seem to love nettle, they're out there, you know, I'm competing with them in a sense. And I'm doing the same thing they're doing on a broader sense, and lo and behold, the nettle throws out a new set of leaves, probably with this, you know, very problem, you know, in reaction to this very consumption that's going on. So I've figured out a way to harvest nettle leaves 2-3 times a season and leave the plants intact so they can follow up with a fourth or a fifth round of leaves and follow their whole cycle and seed out and basically keep the patches intact. I've been harvesting the same patches for years, and they have changed very little. They're relatively unchanged. They're still feeding and interacting with the inner ecosystem, and I'm able to get a crop. And I think that's an example of a way you can manage farming the same way. And what you're talking about with the French intensive is the same idea, that you're basically optimizing a situation, you're making the soil healthy so that it has an abundance of food, and therefore you can grow a rich and healthy, abundant crop such as your lettuce, and harvest it so abundant that you can harvest two kinds of harvest, the baby leaves and then the big plants. And we do a lot of that in this type of agriculture, where we don't waste anything. We grow, you know, get those two cuttings or those two harvests by just paying attention to what's going on to it with it. And when you, on the broader sense of agriculture, I mean, this is, we're away on a very, I guess you have to use the sustainable word, the sustainable end of the spectrum, approaching it from this direction. The further you go towards a human, basically a human-based science-based, technologically-based agriculture, the further you get away from the natural abundance, and you end up needing to, you know, you have to basically, humankind has to fill in the equation with whether it's chemicals or synthetic fertilizers or whatever it is. You basically have to replicate and repeat nature. And the further you get away from nature, I think that the deeper the problems get, whether it's fighting wars with insects by trying to kill them all off and just creating stronger insects and imbalances by killing off their predators, or if it's just synthetically trying to recreate a soil by with chemicals and man-made fertilizers, you know, you don't have the same result. You basically have to replicate nature, and so far I think humankind has a very poor track record of trying to replicate nature and dominate it.
Thank you for that. Fortunately, it seems to me there are a growing number of folks out there like you who recognize that we have to change our attitude toward nature very quickly, and all of us need to learn from it in exactly the way you're describing. That's beautiful, the way you talked about harvesting the nettle.
Is scale an appropriate word for what you're talking about, that we do things in a proper scale?
Absolutely, and I believe that when scale is very important, and when you have a small group of farmers, a family or something akin to that, you know, a few people on a small piece of land that have a very intimate knowledge of that land and a very close relationship and understanding of those cycles, and the larger you get, of course, the you know, less likely you're going to have that type of thing.
Thank you for that. I'm wanting to move on here to organic production of food for people. And I'm going to read a couple of short poems, and then we could hopefully have a bit of a conversation about that.
Sure.
Feeding the earth feeds love and understanding. When I eat organic, my body shows me food becoming energy transparency, a translucent structure, not garbage. For a human being, mindful eating is the way to and of clear mind, elegance, and protection of the soul. There is no other way. Suzuki Roshi said, strictly speaking, there is only one way for the bodhisattva. And Nat Han said, mindful eating brings you love. Lunch today was 99 cents. 99 cents. I love the sound of it ringing up on the register. The heart of my noonday meal to be 1 organic carrot, 2 organic zucchini, all 3 flown in and trucked here from Mexico by Covili. I cut my carrot and zucchini in the roll cut style learned at Zen Center. Layer my organic veggies over yesterday's parboiled organic rosy chicken breast into a small flat skillet on my hot plate. We have been taught to fault the cost to the planet from the cost of shipping that burns petroleum. But according to Gary Hirschberg, CEO of Stonyfield Farms, the more important story is the cost of any non-organic production weighed against the cost to the planet from shipping organic. He claims the former far outweighs the latter. So enjoy your lunch of organic veggies sold at Toby's, shipped from Mexico by Covili without regret. I don't think I want to get into a big debate about that one, but it was interesting to me that this person had actually done this incredible cost analysis to weigh those two factors. So when I was at the market Saturday,
mm-hmm.
and I looked at the produce from your stall there,
uh-huh.
and there were all these baby squash harvested much earlier than I've seen elsewhere,
uh-huh.
and the tiny potatoes, and they were just, they just looked so delectable, so young and tender. And so I would like you to talk about what's coming in at the farm and the crops and the food and what you're offering in general this time of year. I mean, the potatoes and squash are two. Let's see if there's anything. I think that's mostly it. And also, just, you know, tell us what it looks like where you are. Just look around in one of the bowls where you're, you know, growing food. What do you see?
Okay. Well, I'm looking at a bowl right now.
Okay.
And, well, of course, when I look at it, I see the weeds, but that's normal. But right now, as we... going back to what we were just talking about, what you were just talking about, as far as this being the optimal time of year as far as gardens go, I'm seeing, you know, the rows of different crops that are, they just have that sense of abundance and evenness. You know, looking at the beets and the chards and the kales and all of those things, they're just super beautiful. They're you know, very healthy and shining, and it's not a damp, drizzly morning, but it's a foggy morning here, and so everything is very these plants love that, so they're all very, you know, very erect and happy and reaching towards the sky. But as far as what's coming in now, we're entering our peak in this climate region as far as variety and abundance. So the very first tomatoes, I tasted one the other day. They're absolutely delicious, ceviche tomatoes. We'll probably have a few pounds at the market this weekend, and then they're just going to explode from there on out. You know, the basil, another warm weather crop, is finally coming into its own. And our green beans, our Romano beans, which are one of our signature crops, are having their first harvest today, and they're just growing like crazy. So, in a nutshell, everything is just very green and verdant and abundant, and really just entering its prime. So, it interests me that it lines up with this special day that we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that. The special day that we're talking about, to me, sort of symbolizes the stable point in this kind of production of richness that mm-hmm. happens throughout the climate and the geography. I have to go back for just a second, and you're talking about weeds. And I can remember when I was cultivating the beds at Green Gulch, and I would look at the bed, and I could swear the weed was trying to mimic the cultivated crop, so I wouldn't pick it. I mean, there's some kind of you mentioned the I won't say the intelligence of weeds, but there's something going on there.
Well, there's actually a fairly clear answer for that, and it's what I mentioned with the amaranthus. Having been around us humans for so long, that they've adapted to our activities with them, so it makes sense that the weeds that we see the best, the ones with different colors, perhaps have been over time consistently weeded, whereas the ones that the individuals in a plant species that look more like things we grow were missed. And so we basically inadvertently guide genetics in a species in a certain direction, and I'm not one to say how far we've gone, but I'm sure it's a factor in why that is, that the weeds look like the plants.
Very interesting. What else would you like to tell us about the weather and the time of year and what you're cultivating out there?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's in an overall you know, we have a wonderful collection of small organic farms in our area here, and this is the peak of the season, so for those who want to put away food for winter, this is the time to start thinking about that. And, you know, there's the old thinking, oh, you always have to have the first apple or the first peach or the first berry or whatever it is, but the truth is, forget about the first one. Wait till the middle of the season. Give it a few weeks when the crop is abundant and the price falls and it's at its peak of flavor and quality. And that's the time when you want to start, you know, whether you're making jam or you're putting up beans or if you like to put things in the freezer, I'd say this is the time of year to start thinking about that and talk to the growers and say, you know, when are you going to have a lot of cucumbers for pickling or whatever it is. And it's a good time to start thinking about winter and applying that abundance towards your winter food.
Thank you for that.
Do you want to read one more poem, Catherine? I see you have one called Witnessing the Production of Wealth.
Okay, here we go on that one. After overhearing some discussion of this last night at pub night with a lawyer financier and retired corporate chief, I've been reminded of how my elderberry does it as the only tree I planted in my garden strip, to echo the only other large existing tree in the area, a cotoni aster, across the lot. Another tree was needed to balance the space, echo the shape, create structure and a connection in dialogue. The blue elderberry would grow to about the same size, a more native counterpart to this exotic. Get something going on the land. Because of the strong coastal wind sweeping across that lot, the tender elderberry sapling could not grow straight up fast, but had to measure its leaf production carefully against the available light, wind, and ground mass. And so it stayed low and started spreading horizontally, proliferating leaf mass like crazy close to the ground where it could become the wealth of leaves created in harmony with the available sunlight, wind conditions, and topography. It did so perfectly, producing an unexcelled leafy mass, turning CO2 into oxygen, creating cover, saving moisture in the soil. It created a beauty perfectly expressive of the time and place, which could not have been imagined beforehand, as life responded directly to conditions. Given the prevailing wind and weather, it may take some time for it to create a mass able to dialogue with cotoni aster, but when it does, it will be an amazing expression of time and place on this lot, anchored in the completely durable value of its being here on Earth.
Lovely.
Lovely.
Catherine, we need to say goodbye. How do you want to close?
I want to close by saying how much I appreciate that we live in an area where we have people like Peter Martinelli growing food with such a sensitivity to the land and history and nutrition, nutritive value of his food. And it's just a beautiful place to be on the Point Reyes Peninsula.
Thank you, Peter Martinelli. Thank you, Catherine Cook.
Pleasure.
Festival of the First Fruits.